Neil Gaiman is among the most celebrated writers of the fantastic. He's the author of the Sandman comic book series, the award-winning children's novels Coraline and The Graveyard Book, and several novels, including one that's considered a modern classic, American Gods. Gaiman grew up in England and then moved to the American Midwest. At first, he thought it was the most prosaic, unmagical landscape in the world. And then he discovered a place called the House on the Rock.
Snow spun through their headlights and into the windshield as they drove through the darkness. Take Highway 14 west to Spring Green. We'll be meeting everyone at a place called the House on the Rock. You been there? No, said Shadow. But I've seen the signs. The signs for the House on the Rock were all around that part of the world. Oblique, ambiguous signs all across Illinois and Minnesota and Wisconsin. Signs alerting you to the existence of the House on the Rock. Shadow had seen the signs and wondered about them. Did the house balance perilously upon the rock? What was so interesting about the rock? About the house? Shadow was not in the habit of visiting roadside attractions. After almost an hour of driving through towns with names like Black Earth, they turned down a narrow driveway. So what is this place? Asked Shadow, as they walked through the parking lot toward a low, unimpressive wooden building. This is a roadside attraction, said Wednesday, one of the finest, which means it is a place of power. Come again? It's perfectly simple, said Wednesday. In other countries over the years, people recognize the places of power. Sometimes it would be a natural formation. Sometimes it would just be a place that was somehow special. They knew that something important was happening there, that there was some focusing point, some channel, some window to the imminent. And so they build temples or cathedrals or erect stone circles or... Well, you get the idea. There are churches all across the states, though, said Shadow. In every town, sometimes on every block. And about as significant in this context as dentists' offices. No, in the USA, people still get the call, or some of them, and they feel themselves being called to from the transcendent void, and they respond to it by building a model out of beer bottles of somewhere they've never visited. Or by erecting a giant bat house in some part of the country that bats have traditionally declined to visit. Roadside attractions. People feel themselves being pulled to places where, in other parts of the world, they'd recognize that part of themselves that is truly transcendent. And they buy a hot dog and walk around feeling satisfied on a level they cannot truly describe and profoundly dissatisfied on a level beneath that. You have some pretty whacked out theories, said Shadow.
That's Neil Gaiman. Reading from American Gods, the novel that made The House on the Rock, if not a household name, then at least very familiar to Gaiman's fans. He read that excerpt actually at The House on the Rock, as part of a celebration of the 10th anniversary of the book's publication. Steve Paulson was there and pulled Gaiman away from his fans long enough to sit down in an outdoor garden. If you listen, you can hear the fountain.
I think one of the things that's so brilliant about The House on the Rock is that it creeps up on you gradually. The transition between somewhere that's kind of weird and I'm not even sure I'm on planet Earth anymore is this carousel. And you look at it and you realize there are no horses on it. Everything on it is like a child's fever dream nightmare. And it's the biggest in the world and it goes around forever and it doesn't stop and it doesn't slow, which of course... carousels do. They stop and they slow. And it baffled me when I first came to America. And I sort of thought, well, if I could only understand the House on the Rock, I would understand this entire country. I'd understand everything about America that baffles me. That may well have been the reason why I wrote American Gods and why in some ways I sort of kicked off the magic. The book starts getting really magical and strange once they've been to the House on the Rock.
Well, of course, what's so striking is you are, of course, an Englishman yourself, and England is full of mythic elements. I mean, you can barely walk a mile without stumbling over some old stone there. But the image of much of America, especially the Midwest, is we don't really have that kind of history here. We don't have those sacred places. But here you found something sacred, apparently, at House on the Rock in Wisconsin.
I was trying to make sense for myself of the differences between the old world and the new. I was trying to understand why it was that, for example, when the Jack stories came to the Appalachians, we have these amazing collections of Jack stories from the Appalachians where they went and they collected the stories and they're unchanged as they came over from England 400 years earlier, except they have no magic in them. The Jack stories as told in England were filled with wizards and filled with giants and filled with shape changing and magic and all of this stuff. And the ones told in the Appalachians are as if somebody's listened to the story and gone, well, that's a really good story, but that stuff about the giant, that don't exist. We'll take that out. And they sort of were the Jack stories. They're wonderful, they're tricky, they're intelligent, and they are completely devoid of magic. And I thought, I want to try and figure out a fictional context for talking about this.
So part of your project, it sounds like, was to find the magic, or maybe to create the magic in America, in Wisconsin.
I love Wisconsin. I love America, and I love the middle bits of America, the goofy bits. And in some ways, it was, for me, this glorious excuse to drive around the state.
So that was kind of your research, wasn't it, for American Gods, was to do road trips?
My research was road trips where I didn't go on interstates. The idea was I would only go on old roads, and occasionally it was haunting. It was always educational. Sometimes it was very sad. Up in sort of the Northwoods, I'd find myself driving through little towns that had become ghost towns. And you'd be driving through something that felt like a lovely little town, and then you'd realize every store was closed and nobody was living in these houses. And the big sign on the marquee of the local movie theater said, congratulations, Bill and Edie, on your 85th wedding anniversary, 1991. And you're going, that's the last thing that anybody ever put up there. Nobody's here anymore. But all of that stuff wound up feeding into trying to write a book about this area of America and the madness of the winters and the magic of the place.
Hmm. Well, the other thing that's so striking about so many of your books, whether it's American Gods or Neverwhere or Coraline, is that there is another dimension of reality just beyond the wall or just down the sewer grate or something like that. It's as if we're living in the surface reality and then there's something else beyond. Is that the way your mind works?
It's definitely the way my mind works. But having said that, it's also, you know, whenever I wind up sitting down and reading an article in New Scientist, which I have my subscription to, and I sit there and I read articles on New Scientist on the nature of reality, that seems to be what they're saying too. Reality is so incredibly fragile. Most of it's an iceberg and we don't understand it at all. Mm. And I'm very happy with that. I think a world in which we do understand everything would be an incredibly sad sort of place. You know, it's like when people say, well, is there magic? Do you believe in magic? What is magic? And I'm sort of saying, well, magic's a way of seeing the world. Magic's everywhere. You just have to look at things properly.
Now, do you have kind of a worked out metaphysical system of beliefs in your own mind? I mean, because you're playing with these ideas of magic and some sort of other reality. Is this is it all make-believe or is it something more than that?
Oh, it's made up. But I hate the idea that make-believe or the imagination is dismissed as the sort of the bottom rung of the ladder. That's, for me, is absolutely the glory of fiction. I want to tell you a story, and I want you to believe things that aren't true. And I'm going to make up people who never existed. And if I do my job right, maybe I'll make you worry about them or fear for them or be scared of them or hate them or shed tears for them when they die. My job is to tell lies. And not just any lies, because my job is to tell you lies that tell you true things.
Hmm.
A good story that takes you places has a magic all of its own and a magic that's incredibly real. So dismissing things as just made up is something that I find sort of troubling and sad. When I was a kid, people would say to me, don't make stuff up. And teachers would say things like, you're making stuff up, aren't you? And then they'd say, you know what happens to little boys who make things up? And I didn't. And I had to wait and find out. And what actually happens if you make things up and you do it well is they give you all these lovely literary awards and you get a wonderful big house and international travel and you get to sell lots of books and make people really, really happy. It's great.
Do you worry that our modern culture is losing its sense of magic?
No, I don't, because I think you find magic is everywhere, and wonder. It's not even the sense of magic. I think it's much more a sense of wonder, a sense of infinite potential. And for me, that taps absolutely and 100% into the imagination, which is the root of everything. Everything you see, any building, any microphone, any chair, somebody imagined it before it could exist.
40 years ago, Alex Jordan began to build a house on a high jut of rock in a field he did not own, and even he could not have told you why. And people came to see him build it, the curious and the puzzled, and those who were neither, and those who could not honestly have told you why they came. So he did what any sensible American male of his generation would do. He began to charge them money. Nothing much, a nickel each perhaps, or a quarter, and he kept building and the people kept coming. So he took those quarters and nickels and made something even bigger and stranger. He built these warehouses on the land beneath the house and filled them with things for people to see, and then the people came to see them. Millions of people come here every year. Why? But Wednesday simply smiled, and they walked into the dimly lit, tree-lined streets of yesterday, along a covered walkway, in through another exit door, and they were in the carousel room. Calliope music played, a Strauss waltz, stirring and occasionally discordant. A sign proclaimed it was the largest in the world, said how much it weighed, how many thousand light bulbs to be found in the chandeliers that hung from it in Gothic profusion, and forbade anyone from climbing on it or from riding on the animals. And such animals! Shadow stared, impressed in spite of himself, at the hundreds of full-size creatures who circled on the platform of the carousel. Real creatures, imaginary creatures, and transformations of the two. Shadow inspected a bulldog and a mer creature and an elephant with a golden howdah, and he climbed onto the back of a creature with an eagle's head and the body of a tiger and held on tight. The rhythm of the Blue Danube waltz rippled and rang and sang in his head. The lights of a thousand chandeliers glinted and prismed, and for a heartbeat, Shadow was a child again, and all it took to make him happy was to ride the carousel. He stayed perfectly still, riding his eagle tiger at the center of everything, and the world revolved around him. Then the lights went out, and Shadow saw the gods.
Neil Gaiman, reading from American Gods. He spoke with Steve Paulson at the House on the Rock in Wisconsin.